Is creativity a special gift that only a few people possess, or is it something that's within all of us? This is Weekday. From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silmans. Sir Ken Robinson believes every child's a born artist. The problem comes in as we get older. The public schools tend to stamp out our creative tendencies, and so do our workplaces. Sir Ken Robinson was a former arts educator. These days you can find him talking with people, with governments around the world about creative problem solving. Sir Ken Robinson's new book is called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. Welcome so much to our studio.
Thank you for asking me. It's a great pleasure.
I guess first we should be clear on what you mean when you use that word creativity. What is it?
Well, creativity to me is the process of having original ideas that have value. It's really important that. I mean, it's not just having original ideas, because people can have all kinds of original ideas which are kind of wacky and off the point. Sheer novelty is not the answer to it, really. But it's having ideas that really add up to something and are important in some way. The thing about it is that, as you say, a lot of people think they're not creative. But this isn't just about the arts. I think it's important to say that. You know, that you can be tremendously creative in science, in mathematics, in technology, in working with people, in broadcasting, in anything at all that involves your intelligence. So I think a big piece of it is that we greatly underestimate our intelligence in the first place.
In your book, you talk about what intelligence is, and there are many books written. Howard Gardner at Harvard talks about, I don't remember how many intelligences he has these days, 8, 9, 10, something like that.
We're up to 8 now.
Yeah, but the standard definition of that is not what we're talking about. Intelligence means somebody's smart and does well in school. I think that's how a lot of people define it.
Well, what interests me is how many people I've met who've done brilliantly well in all sorts of different fields who'll go on to say, of course, they're not very smart, or I didn't do very well at school. You know, I think of entrepreneurs, of business leaders, of you know, community leaders. It's often true of people who work in the arts, not necessarily. But I know brilliant musicians and painters and dancers who say, well, I'm not very smart. And they clearly are. What it points to me is that we've grown up with a very limited idea of intelligence.
You begin your new book, The Element, with the story of a girl named Jillian, now a woman named Jillian. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about her.
I used to be on the board of the Royal Ballet. People can't see this on the radio, but I'm extraordinarily well toned, you know, as you can see myself. And I won't tell people what I'm wearing, Jillian is a wonderful woman, and now in her 70s, I asked her how she became a dancer in the first place. I'm very fascinated by how some people manage to find this thing that drives their life forward. And she said that it nearly didn't happen, that when she was in school, she was a pretty poor student. And she fidgeted a lot and was staring out the windows. And the school thought she had a problem and wrote to her parents to say that. I think now, as I say in the book, they'd say she had attention deficit disorder. She was sent to see a psychologist. And the psychologist sat down with Jillian. He sort of led her into this room and sat on a bench at the far end of it. For about 20 minutes, he talked to her mother about all these problems Jillian seemed to be having at school and apparently causing at school. And Jillian just sat perfectly still, you know, intimidated as a young kid might be. She had her best frock on and was trying to behave and not fidget. She sat in the hands. Anyway, at the end of this, the psychologist said to Jillian, "You've been very, very patient, Jillian, but I have to speak to your mother privately, and we're going out the room." And they did. But as they left the room, he turned the radio on that was on his desk. And when they got into the corridor, he said to her mother, "Just stand here and watch what she does." They stood where she couldn't be seen. There was a window back in. And the minute they're out of the room, she was on her feet moving to the music. And they watched quietly for several minutes. And then he turned to her mother and he said, "You know, Mrs. Lynn, Jillian isn't sick. She's a dancer. Take her to a dance school." I said to Jillian, "What happened?" She said, "I can't tell you how wonderful it was. I went into this room and it was full of people like me. People who couldn't sit still. People who had to move to think." Anyway, the upshot of this was she was eventually auditioned for the Royal Ballet. She joined the Royal Ballet. She travelled the world as a soloist with the company. She left eventually, as ballet dancers do. She formed her own company. She created shows on Broadway and in London. Then she met Andrew Lloyd Webber. She choreographed Cats and Phantom of the Opera. She's given pleasure to millions and is one of the most successful choreographers in living memory. and she's a multimillionaire. Now, what I'm saying is that somebody else might have put her on medication and told her to calm down. What happened here was that somebody looked into Gillian's eyes and saw who she was. And that's a big piece of the book, really, is that we're all our talents are different. And the great pressure culturally, and particularly in education, is to standardise everybody. And when you do that, you flatten out differences and, I think, frustrate the talents of too many people.
One of the things that's striking about Gillian's story, and the stories of a lot of the folks that you've included in this book, but probably many of us, is that yourself as well, is that somebody recognized something in this girl. A lot of us might have that same, maybe not ability to dance, but some other passion, and we can't recognize it, and nobody helps us do that. I mean, I thought that was the fortune that she had.
Yes, there are lots of examples in the book of that, mm-hmm. from all sorts of different fields. It strikes me that very many adults, a lot of people seem to me to be doing things that they don't get a lot of pleasure or fulfillment from. They've kind of wandered into it, or through force of circumstances or pressures. And yet some people are living lives where they couldn't imagine doing anything else. And so the different, you know, they are, so to speak, in their element. So the book is partly about, well, what is it to be in your element? Mm-hmm. And then what are the things that stop it? And then what are some things you can do about it? And one of the things that stops it are family pressures, other people's expectations. And very often in the lives of people who have found this thing that drives them forward, there was somebody, a teacher, a friend, a colleague, somebody who in a way saw what was there in this person before they saw it themselves.
Well, sometimes that is a teacher. Sometimes yeah. that does happen when you're in school.
Oh, very often. One of the people we mentioned, I didn't interview him for the book, but his story was out there and I wanted to include it, is James Earl Jones. When he was at school, he stuttered. And he's one of the most famous voices in the world at the moment. He still has a problem with it. But he had an English teacher come to the school, and James apparently told him that he wrote poetry, and he saw that he had a problem speaking. So one day, they'd handed in a poetry assignment, and he said to him, I don't think that you wrote this poem. And he said, well, I did. He said, well, stand up and recite it if you wrote it.
Mm.
And he did. He stood up and recited it flawlessly. And he said it was the first time, pretty much, in his life that he realized that he could do that. And it was the beginning of his development as a performer and as an actor.
Ken Robinson, author of a new book called The Element, says schools, at least the public schools, can do quite a bit to dampen not only your enthusiasm, but maybe even your exploration of the world around you. Sir Ken Robinson is our guest, and I wanted to talk about standardized tests because since the passage of No Child Left Behind on the federal level, America seems really driven to make sure our children achieve the basics of fluency in mathematics and literature, science. Is that necessarily a bad thing?
I think it's a very good thing. And I should say, by the way, that I now live in America. I mean, I'm a permanent resident here, so I haven't just come over here to take shots. You know, I mean, I know that most teachers don't like this either. It's not deliberate that our talents are often marginalized, but it is systematic. And the reason it's systematic is because we have a culture of education, particularly, I should say, I think in America these days, which has become obsessed with standardizing. And what I'm arguing for is the highest standards, but based on a view of diversity, of individuality. You know, we're not all the same. It's just obvious to say it. You know, every mother knows that their child has something different about them, unique. Of course, there are some things we all have to learn and know about. We don't want every child inventing their own system of literature or their own system of mathematics or saying, well, I don't care how you do it. This is how I do algebra. I know it doesn't work, but I like it. You know, there are some things that, you know, we all need to know. There's common cultural knowledge. But the thing that makes a difference in a life is discovering our individual view of things, our individual talents that make us who we are. And the culture of standardized testing, I think, has flattened out and homogenized many schools across the country and taken away from teachers the discretion to be what they need to be to children and students, which is both a teacher and a mentor and somebody who can help cultivate their talents.
Somebody said to me last week, because we've just elected a new superintendent of public instruction at the state level who would like to change significantly a standardized test that's been in place. And this person said to me, well, if they do away with it's called the WASL, if they do away with this, what will the teachers teach to? And I'm wondering what your response is to a question like that.
Excuse me. You see, and this isn't to say that we should do away with standards or that we should do away with standardized testing. Standardized tests can have a real value. There's no question about that. My problem is the way that they have come to dominate education and almost become the purpose of it. Mm. You see, if you think of another field, it's always useful, I think, to look at related areas or analogous areas. If I go for a medical examination, I want some standardized tests. You know, I really do. You know, I want to know what my cholesterol level is compared to yours and everybody else's. I don't want it on some personal scale my doctor made up in the car on the way in. You know, I don't want him telling me my cholesterol is what I call level orange. You know, like, what is that? Tell me. I can handle the information. But I don't go there just to find out what the situation is. That's a diagnostic process. I want to know what to do about it after that. So standardized tests that help us figure out what level kids have reached in terms of literacy and mathematics are good. But actually, most standardized tests go to the lowest common denominator. Some kids are way above it. Some are way behind. We end up teaching the tests, and it flattens everything out. But also, while we're at it, let's have some standardized tests for music and art and dance and theatre and physical education, all the things that make a human being what they are. But don't have them dominate the culture of schools. Have them be part of the supportive process by which we reach our highest standards personally.
My guest this hour, Ken Robinson, Sir Ken Robinson, to you. His book is called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. We have this email from Betty who says, it seems we're very focused on finding just one passion. What if there isn't just one? What if you have many? I find myself jumping from one thing to another all the time, and it's frustrating. I can never find just one thing to become really good at.
Well, I sympathize with this. And by the way, I think she's right. You know, we're not limited. I mean, I haven't... It's not for me to set a quotient here, you know. I think some people find they're tremendously good at all kinds of things. But often enough, something may present itself that you have to drill down on. Interesting, one of the people I interviewed for the book is Paul McCartney. I was talking to him about his own time at school. And I said, was he good at music at school? And he said he was hopeless. He went through the whole of his education and nobody thought he had any musical talent. One of the other pupils in the same music stream at the same school was George Harrison, you know, the lead guitarist of the of the Beatles. And Paul said nobody thought George had any talent either, didn't notice anything. So I was saying last night, you know, that this one music teacher in Liverpool had half the Beatles in his class. You know,
didn't notice.
Didn't spot it. Now, the point about this, you see, is I make an analogy, and I think it's a powerful one. I think it's absolutely accurate. That we've become used to the idea, largely through the work of Al Gore, Rachel Carson, the Green Movement, that there is a crisis in the world's natural resources. There is. You know, I mean, I think if people don't think that, they haven't really looked at the issue properly. But I think there's a crisis in human resources too, that we, for the same reasons, we make very partial use of our own abilities. And there are all kinds of reasons, which I talk about and some of them I've just mentioned. But I think the analogy is really important because we accept that natural resources in the earth are often buried deep. You have to go looking for them. You know, the diamonds and gold aren't just lying around. The oil's not just sitting on the floor. You know, you have to go digging for some of this stuff. And I think it's the same with people. Often their real talents are buried deep, and they're not apparent even to the people who have them. They need certain conditions to show themselves. You know, I mean, what would have become of Paul McCartney and George Harrison if they hadn't been in Liverpool in the 60s, if they hadn't met John Lennon? You know, I don't know. Elvis Presley wasn't allowed in the glee club at school. They said he'd ruin their sound. You know, Elvis, you know, I mean, you know, we all know what great heights the glee club went on to once they kept Elvis out. But there are lots of examples of that, that people need the opportunity. So what I'm really encouraging people to say is if there's something you've always longed to do, go and try it at least. And try something you wouldn't have thought you might try and see how you respond to it.
It's scary, though. It is.
Well, yeah, it's scary, but it's also exhilarating if it works.
Sir Ken Robinson is a teacher, a writer, and a speaker. His new book is called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. Sir Ken Robinson, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Marcy.
This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle.